everybody, and welcome back to I Just Want to Talk About the Bible. If this is your first time joining us, then welcome. I am glad that you're here. My name is Christian Keeter, and I live in the southeast of the United States of America with my amazing, beautiful, godly wife, Lacey, and our two wonderful daughters, Felicity and Serenity. So today we will be talking about Psalm 73. So if you have a Bible with you, feel free to go ahead and open it up to Psalm 73. But if you don't, if you're at the gym or driving or doing yard work or something, then no problem at all. I'll do my best to explain things in a clear way. But Psalm 73 is where we're going. And I'm not going to do a whole bunch of introduction. We're just going to jump right into it. And we will discuss it as we go through it. However, I will say right at the outset that there is something very specific in this psalm that I would love for all of us to grasp, including me, to really grab hold of and begin to just apply in our own lives. And I think that if we do, it would really, really change and even revolutionize many things. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's just get into Psalm 73. So I've got the passage opened up before me here. So at the beginning, it says, a psalm of Asaph. So a good first question would be, well, who is Asaph? Fantastic question. I won't get into it too long right here, but simply, Asaph was a Levite. He was a member of the tribe of Levi. And during David's time, he was a part of the tabernacle choir. So you'll remember the temple was built by David's son Solomon, so the house of the Lord was still the tabernacle at this point, and he was one of the singers at the tabernacle. He was, in a sense, kind of like he would lead people in worship. And so what I'm going to do for anybody who's interested, I will include a link to an article. It's a short article, like three paragraphs long. In the description of this episode, talking a little bit more about Asaph and providing scriptures with where you can kind of piece together who he was. So I will include that in the show notes below. But let's get into the actual body of Psalm 73 and stop and comment along the way. So beginning in verse 1, truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. So that's the end of verse 2, and it leads us to ask this question. Well, why, Asaph? Why did your feet almost stumble, and why had your steps, nearly slipped? Well, we get the answer to that in the next verse. Verse 3 says, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. So this, three-verse introduction kind of sets up the remainder of the psalm, where he looks at the prosperity of the wicked, and he even says that he was envious, and this led to him almost stumbling and his feet almost slipping. So continuing in verse 4, he's going to list out some of the descriptions of these people. So continuing in verse 4 and following, he says, for they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. So that was verses 4 through 12. And so he's describing these people that he was envious of. He calls them the arrogant. He calls them the wicked. He says, they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. And so what's being communicated here? They're well fed. They're not going hungry. They are not enduring any kind of perceivable suffering in this life. He goes on to say, they're not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. And so they seem to be almost like immune to the struggles of just the average person. And he says this leads to them. Again, he used the word arrogant earlier. He says, therefore, pride is their necklace and violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. I'm just rereading some of the verses here. But then these people, they scoff and they speak with malice. They threaten oppression. They even set their mouths against the heavens. Like, that, you know, a few verses down, these people are quoted as saying, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? So they're even kind of arrogantly, speaking against the Lord. And he sums it up by saying, these are the wicked. He says, behold, these are the wicked, always at ease, they increase in riches. And so he goes through, describes these people. He talks about how they don't seem to suffer like others do. They don't have any difficulties. And I mean, but they're prideful, they're arrogant. They are rebellious towards the Lord. They're oppressive. They threaten oppression. They scoff and speak maliciously. Like, I'm just, you know, just reviewing some of these things here. And so that's verse 12, and that leads us down to verse 13, and this leads us to the conclusion that Asaph initially reached. Now, let me clarify something before we proceed here, just so there's not any confusion. What makes these people he's talking about wicked is not the fact that they're, you know, well-fed and aren't suffering and, says they increase in riches. That's not what makes them wicked. But rather what he's saying is, why do they seem to be getting all of these good things when they are wicked? Why does their wickedness seem to be rewarded with blessing? This is just asking the question, why do the wicked prosper? And so I didn't want there to be any misunderstanding about that. That's not what makes them wicked, but rather it's the question of, why are they being blessed and living in such, you know, ease since they are wicked? So I just wanted to clarify that, but let's return to verse 13 and carry on. So returning to verse 13, how did he respond initially to this? So continuing in verse 13 and following, he says, all in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. So let's pause there. That was verses 13 through 15. And so what is he feeling? He's looking at these people. He's looking at how they prosper, how they are not walking in obedience to the Lord, how they are not walking in holiness, how they're not, they're just wrong. And so what does he say? He looks at himself and he says, it's pointless that I've kept my heart clean. It's pointless that I've washed my hands in innocence. In other words, he's essentially saying, what's been the point of me doing the right thing? What's been the value of, you know, obedience to the Lord? These people over here are doing their own thing. They're prideful, they're wicked, and yet they're prospering. And here I am doing the right thing, and I'm suffering. How can this be? Like, I have pointlessly done the right thing, is the conclusion that he is currently at. Yet he still knows. He knows he can't just go around saying that. Like he said down in verse 15, he said, if I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. So to put it, let's see here, I'll pull it up in another translation, because just to make it even clearer. So in the New Living Translation, he said, if I had really spoken this way to others, I would have been a traitor to your people. And so he knows, like, he's like, I can't, I'm feeling all these way, this way, I'm feeling these thoughts, I'm feeling like I've done the right thing pointlessly, I'm looking at the prosperity of the wicked, there's this internal turmoil, and he said, but I can't vocalize this to others, otherwise, I mean, to use his terminology, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. And so he's feeling this tension of what he's experiencing, what he's seeing, what he's feeling, but at the same time, not wanting to lead others astray. So then here we are in verses 16 and 17. This is the turning point. Up to this point in the psalm, you know, there's the introduction, and then after the introduction, beginning in verse 4, it's just spiraling down. It's just going down. He's looking at the arrogant. He's wrestling with how he's feeling about it. There's envy towards them. There is just all this stuff. But here it is. This is the moment. Verses 16 and 17 say, But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. So what is he saying? He's saying, but when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. And so he's just, you know, he's trying to understand this. He's trying to wrap his mind around it. And he says, it's a wearisome task. He's like, it seems like he's almost like saying, I just could not wrap my mind around this. Like, as I tried to sort through this in my mind, I was just not, it was just not making sense to me. But then there's this beautiful word, until. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. So when he uses that word sanctuary, when he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, what is that a reference to? Well, remember that, like I said, Asaph was alive during the time of David. Now, I don't know how long Asaph lived exactly, and I don't know exactly where the timelines overlap. So remember, during David's time, the house of the Lord was still the tabernacle. Then David's son Solomon built the temple. And you can read about, you know, Solomon building the temple in the early chapters of 1 Kings. But for both the tabernacle and the temple, what were these places? They were where God dwelled. They, you know, they were called God's house. The temple is called God's house, the tabernacle. And so the idea is, and we know that God is, that he is omnipresent, to use the big word, meaning that he's everywhere. And so it wasn't like God was not anywhere outside of the tabernacle or the temple, but his presence was there in a very special way. And we know that the Holy of Holies, the innermost part of the tabernacle and temple, was where his presence was, I guess I could say like the strongest or something like that. I don't know if that's necessarily the right terminology, but I think it kind of communicates the point. And so simply put, when it says he went into the sanctuary of God, and I mean, he wasn't going into the Holy of Holies at this point, you know, because the only person that could go into the Holy of Holies was the high priest once a year on the Day of Atonement. I mean, this is getting into the New Testament stuff as well, but just, you know, when Jesus died and the veil was torn, separating the Holy of Holies, and what does this symbolize? It symbolized that, you know, access to God was opened. Through what Jesus did, we were all welcomed into his presence. So you remember this, he's on the cross, the veil is torn from top to bottom, the wall of separation between God and us has been removed. But all that to say, not in the Holy of Holies, but just in the tabernacle, kind of generally, is where Asaph would, of course, be referring. What he'd be referring to here. So, but the point is, I don't want to get too, you know, granular with all that. But what's the point? What is the point that's being made here? What does it mean practically when it says, "I went into the sanctuary of God"? The idea is until he got into his presence, until he was with the Lord in a special way. And so, because it's not like, oh, he walked into the tabernacle, just through, you know, into the outer courts of the tabernacle, then all of a sudden it's like, boom, everything changed now. It's like, no, I mean, this is carrying the idea of him being with the Lord and him encountering, and through that time in the Lord's presence, encountering a change of perspective. And so, it says, until I went into the sanctuary of God and I discerned their end. So what is this change in perspective that he got? Well, up until this point, he was only looking at the here and now. He's like, these people aren't suffering. There's nothing negative going on in their life. Look at them. They're in ease and I'm struggling. You know, I have a hard, you know, life is hard sometimes. So it doesn't seem to be the way for them. And so that's how he's feeling. But he goes into the sanctuary. He gets into the Lord's presence. He probably was worshiping. I mean, that's what he did. Remember, he was in the tabernacle choir. But what happened? He got a bit more of an eternal perspective. He got a bit more of a heavenly perspective. He says, then I discerned their end. And so we'll talk more about this in a minute. But let's let the passage just continue to unfold. So continuing in, I'll read verses 18 through 20 here. He says, truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. Like a dream when one awakes, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. And so that's the end of those three verses there. And so what's happening, he's been looking just at the wicked's life here and now. But he gets in there and he just realizes, you know, what is the ultimate destiny of the wicked? You know, and what is his ultimate destiny? His being Asaph's. He said, speaking of them, just to reiterate, he said, how they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. And so what's the idea here? The idea is that, you know, we're all accountable to the Lord. Regardless of what someone's life looks like in the moment, we're all accountable to the Lord. And let me say, anyone can repent at any time. We were all wicked at one point. We were all separated from the Lord. Like it says in, you know, Romans, 6:23, there is no Romans 6:26, Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin is death. You know, we're all separated from the Lord, initially. And so anyone can repent, anyone can move out of that camp of wickedness, you know, but like Jesus says, no one comes to the Father but through him. In John 14:6, that there's no other way. I've talked about this plenty in other episodes. But my point is just this. Asaph got a bit broader of a perspective. What is that big perspective? You know, we're all accountable to the Lord, and he's going to make everything right. He's going to make, you know, everything right, and I have not been forgotten, regardless of what I'm seeing right now. It's not pointless that I've kept my hands clean, and this idea that the wicked are just, you know, don't have to have any sort of like accountability, they're doing what they want all day long, that's just false. It might seem that way today, but ultimately we all, you know, we're all accountable to the Lord. So then he continues in verse 21. I'll read 21 through 26. I might pause some there too. But he says, when my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast towards you. So that's actually Paul's there. This verse is 21 and 22. Have you ever felt that way? I know that I have. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. Have you ever felt or found yourself rather being brutish and ignorant toward the Lord? I have. When I've been in situations that I haven't liked or haven't understood, or I've had a really narrow, short-sighted perspective, you better believe that I've been that way. It doesn't make it right, but it's real. And I, for one, really appreciate the transparency that we see in this psalm. It's like, yeah, that's really relatable. But look what he says next, verses 23 through 26. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Let's pause there. I find it really interesting here. He says in verse 25, whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. What a, you know, difference. Because this whole psalm started off with him saying that he was envious of the arrogant when he saw the prosperity of the wicked. He was envious of these people and the ease they had in life. And now he's saying, there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you, talking to the Lord. Complete reversal. Completely different perspective. Complete 180 here. And then he's also been humbled through this process. Like he had just said a moment ago, nevertheless, I am continually with you. Despite the fact that he was brutish and ignorant, he says, talking to the Lord, you hold my right hand. I don't know about you guys, but that's what I want. I want the Lord to take me by the hand and just lead me like a little child. Because, I mean, the longer that I walk with the Lord, the more I see that I'm just like not qualified to make good decisions. I'm not qualified to, you know, walk in my own wisdom. I just need him to take me by the hand and to guide me. He said in verse 26, my flesh and my heart may fail, Which, hey, let's just acknowledge that seems to be what happened in this scenario with him. He was really struggling. His flesh and his heart failed. But then what does he say? He goes on to say, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Beautiful passage of scripture. And then the last two verses of the psalm, verses 27 and 28, just to wrap it up, say, for behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. And that's the end of the psalm, 28 verses long. And so he says here, he says, those who are far from you shall perish. He says, you put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. And so again, he has this big perspective. And what has this big perspective led to? It's led to gratitude, because he realizes he's not in that camp. He's in the camp of the faithful. And the Lord takes care. The Lord has not abandoned him. Even though he felt like things were not going well, he says, nevertheless, I am continually with you. Even when he didn't realize it, even when he didn't see it, nevertheless, I am continually with you. And even when you don't see it, and even when I don't see it, and even when we feel like things are not going well, and even when we look at other people who don't seem to care a thing about the Lord and how their lives are so much apparently easier than ours, we don't actually know what's going on. Nevertheless, he is continually with you. He is continually with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. For those of us who are in Christ Jesus, for those of us who have put our faith and trust in him, we're secure in that. And so we can just rest. We can just exhale. Something really cool about this psalm, just this is kind of like a literary sort of thing, but if you look at it, it's broken up into really kind of cool units. So it starts off, he has a little bit of an introduction in verse 1. And verse 1 through 3 is all kind of like an introduction. Then he has the kind of thing that he just read there at the very, very end, 27 and 28. But the whole psalm, it's like broken into two halves with a turning point. The first half is the downward spiral of how he's struggling, struggling, struggling. That's, you know, you could just kind of roughly make that verses, you know, like 2 through 15. But then verses 18 through 28 are like the complete opposite of what he's been wrestling with this whole time. Like we've already pointed out some examples. It's this just upward spiral, and it just ends on such a high note. He's humbled, but he is just so confident in the Lord's presence, and that the Lord's working, and that the Lord is just and righteous. And what was the turning point? It was verses 16 and 17. Specifically verse 17, really, but 16 and 17 say, but when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. So what's the point that I'm getting at here? The point is that a word from the Lord changes everything. My point is that just encountering God in a quality, genuine sort of way, not just a ritualistic checklist sort of thing where it's like, yeah, I read my Bible, check, but no, like genuinely encountering the Lord, where it's you and him, and he shows you something. It changes everything. It changes everything. And you've probably had this sort of moment, I know I have, and I'll share an example of this in a minute, where it's just like you were feeling one way, thinking one way, you got with the Lord, and you feel like in that time he showed you some things. He kind of opened your eyes up. He broadened your perspective on the situation. And that came with renewed excitement, renewed fervor and energy, renewed devotion, like all this stuff. In fact, it's very much kind of like in Isaiah 40, really popular, beautiful passage, where he says, Isaiah 40, 29 through 31, where he says, he gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But then listen to this part. That was verses 29 through 30 that I just read, but listen to what he says next. This is verse 31. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And that's the end of the Isaiah 40, 29 through 31 passage. But listen to that. They who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. And this is what we're talking about. Getting into his presence, letting him speak to us, letting him and I use the word letting him. He can do whatever he wants. And obviously, we don't have to let the Lord do anything, but rather putting ourselves in a position to hear. It's kind of like, you remember what Jesus would say, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. An example of that would be Matthew 11:15. Yeah, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. So it's kind of like that, where it's like the Lord can speak at any time. The Lord can obviously break through. But the question is, are we putting ourselves in a position to listen? Are we putting ourselves in a position to really hear and obey and receive what the Lord will show us? And another way of putting it, you know, are we going into the sanctuary of God? Now, I just say, when I'm saying the sanctuary of God, I am speaking kind of generally of being in his presence. Because remember, the tabernacle, the temple, that was where God's presence was. That's where he dwelled. And I know that sanctuary is a term that many churches will use to refer to where you go to worship the Lord together, where you go to hear the sermon preached. And I absolutely think that that falls under this banner where it's like, yes, we go there to hear from the Lord. We absolutely do. But I don't want it to be just restricted to a physical sanctuary at a church. Although, yes, you will absolutely encounter the Lord there, and we should be expecting that and asking him to speak to us through the service every week. I'm just speaking generally of being in the presence of God and, you know, worshiping him and everything that that entails, but really just listening to him and letting him change our perspective. So, example from my own life. I was meeting with my mentor recently and just kind of going through a lot of the stuff that I feel like is kind of happening in my life, a lot of fears that I've seen that are in my heart and how I think those things really affect me, and just talking through stuff. We all need somebody to talk to. I say that a lot, but we all should have a person that we can go and talk to about how we're doing emotionally, spiritually, what we feel like the Lord is showing us, a person to bounce things off of. That's just a vitally important role. And we should also try to be that for other people. It's definitely a two-way street. But we need somebody like that in our lives. And so I was talking to him about these things, and he directed me to James. And this is the book of James. This is going to be relevant to what we've been talking about in Psalm 73. And he encouraged me to spend a bit of time really meditating specifically on James 1, 5, and 6, and also the verses around it. But I'll just read those two verses really quick. He says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind." And that's the end of the quote. And he encouraged me just to start coming to the Lord before this, or come before the Lord with this stuff. The fears I was feeling and just all sorts of things. Just to be completely honest with you guys, I just have a lot of questions in my mind right now. A lot of areas where, we need some direction for practical decisions that need to be made, and just a lot of questions even like about, like I said, fears in my own heart, which is like, okay, Lord, what is the root of this? What was even the entry point of this? If that's helpful to know, what can I do about it now? And so my mentor encouraged me to begin praying through this and doing exactly what this verse says, which is asking the Lord for wisdom. And I imagine I'll probably come back and do another episode on this passage from James, and we can get more in depth with it. But so I start doing this. I start asking the Lord, and I go and I sit down, and I just start praying. And just talking to the Lord, expressing everything that, you know, I'd been talking to my mentor about to the Lord. And I felt like, the Lord really changed my perspective. He really shifted my perspective in one of the areas that I brought before him. And I believe he'll do it with the rest as well in time as I continue to seek him, and continue to ask him for wisdom. But the one area was this. I have historically really not liked conflict. It's historically made me really uncomfortable, conflict and tension, and even having other people upset with me. And who knows, maybe that's why I like podcasting so much, because it's just me talking into a microphone. I mean, this microphone has never gotten upset with me, at least not yet. But returning to what I was saying, what's really interesting is that at the same time, you know, I was talking to the Lord about all this stuff, I was in three independent situations in which there was just some kind of like, they were just kind of tense situations. Three different groups of people, but all three scenarios were going to require conversations that historically I would want to avoid. conversations where you're going to have to address things, where have to just have some uncomfortable conversations. And so those things are like, on my radar. They're there, and they're just, there's nothing I can do about it. Like, I can try to run away from, I can try to avoid him. But if I do that, it's not actually good for the other parties involved either. And so all this is just kind of there. And during my course, of praying and talking to the Lord, he shifted my perspective. He really did. He shifted my perspective. And in an instant, what I feel like he showed me was, it was kind of like when the Israelites were at the Red Sea. They were being pursued by Pharaoh's army. There they are at the Red Sea. And so here's the scenario. They couldn't go back, obviously. There's an army back there. He can't go back. They can't go around the Red Sea. The only way was to go through it. To go through it and come out the other side. But as they went through it, there was supernatural provision. The Lord held back the waters. He didn't let them get swallowed up. He brought them safely to the other side. And so as I was thinking about that, I was like, the Red Sea is very much like, I feel like what the Lord showed me was like that the Red Sea was very much like, or my kind of fear of conflict is very much like the Red Sea. Or it's like, listen, I can't go away. I can't run away from it. I can't try to go around it. And the only way to get to the other side is to go through it. As I prayed about it later some more, I feel like, the Lord might have connected it as well to right when the Israelites, when they were on the edge of the promised land, and 10 of the 12 spies were like, no, we can't go in there. There's giants in there. We're going to die. We can't go in there. And then Joshua and Caleb were like, no, we can absolutely do this. In fact, let me go to Numbers 14 right now. Numbers 14, Caleb. Caleb's great. Let's see here. So he says, he said in Numbers 14, beginning halfway through verse 7, he said, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. That was Numbers 14, halfway through verse 17 through verse 9. And so in a similar sort of way, it's just like, well, what are the, figurative giants of the land that I'm describing right here? Well, for me, it was this whole fear of conflict thing, fear of upsetting people. It kind of touches on this whole thing of like, oh, I don't want to feel rejected. I don't want to feel abandoned. I don't want to feel criticized. I get uncomfortable whenever there's conflict. And so in that way, I could be tempted to do the very same thing that the Israelites did, which was, that looks scary. I don't want to go over there. But it's like, but the Lord has called me to do certain things. He's called me to, for example, be a peacemaker. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. He's called all Christians to do that. It's, one of the Beatitudes. In Matthew 5, he's called us all to, in Galatians chapter 6, he says, brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Like, we are called to lovingly address one another when we're wrong, and to make peace, I've heard it pointed out before that making peace and keeping peace are different matters. Keeping peace is just conflict aversion, while making peace can be having the difficult conversations, but both parties come out the other side. And now where there is peace between us. But the point is just that the Lord has just so opened my eyes to help me see and to show me that he is setting me free from this fear. And he's doing it by leading me through the very thing that I have sought to avoid in the past. But the interesting thing is, I'm excited about it. I'm, energized. I'm filled up. I'm encouraged. That doesn't mean I necessarily enjoy it, but I know that the Lord is at work, and this is just the function of the Lord just opening my eyes to this, just a change in perspective where he has helped me see things from his perspective. And he would do the same thing in your life. Like it said in, like we saw in James 1, 5, and 6, that offer for wisdom is for anyone who would ask. And so I actually, coming back to those conversations I was referring to a minute ago, I've actually had a couple of them already. And guess what? They weren't as bad as I expected. And I felt pretty good coming out the other side. It didn't kill me. In fact, it didn't even really hurt. There was some stress going into it, but it was not nearly as bad as I thought it'd be. And obviously, there's a right and wrong way to have these sorts of conversations. We always want to speak the truth in love. We want to, be full of grace and truth. Like in Galatians 6, which I just read a moment ago, Galatians 6:1, we want to do things in a spirit of gentleness. And there's plenty more scriptures we could talk about regarding that. But and I'm not going to go off into a whole conversation about that. But I want to keep this firmly rooted in the original conversation about Psalm 73. This isn't just an example about, let me tell you guys about something that's happening in my life. No, this is an example to serve the point that, you know, we're trying to see here from Psalm 73. Asaph had a very specific view, a very specific perspective as he looked at things. But when he encountered the Lord, when he heard from the Lord, when he got into the Lord's presence, it changed everything. It was a total reversal. And my example is just an example of, hey, I've experienced the same thing in my life recently. Like, it's not even been a full week, I think, since I feel like the Lord showed me this. One thing that my pastor says is, if nothing changes, then nothing changes. In other words, if we do what we've always done, then we will get what we've always gotten. And so, for you, what are the areas where you need a change in perspective? What are the areas where you need the Lord to come in and open your eyes to see things differently? Where do you need wisdom? Where do you need for Him to really speak a word from the Lord? I just want to encourage you. You know, based off of James 1, 5, and 6, based off of what we've seen in Psalm 73, I believe that what He did for Asaph and what He did for me, He'll do for you. But let's put ourselves in a position to hear. Let's put ourselves in a position to listen. Let's be still and pray and just seek Him and just lay out all these things before Him and just simply say, Lord, please give me wisdom. Please open my eyes. Please help me see this the way that You do. Please show me what You want me to do here, whatever it may be. I don't know what your specific scenario is. But the thing about James, the passage I read a little while ago, it says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. It says that He will give it, that He will give wisdom if we ask. And we need to ask in faith, and that's definitely there, with no doubting. And so, so what does this look like? It means that we ask the Lord for wisdom and then believe that He's going to give it. And that faith that He will answer that prayer and give us the wisdom according to His word will give so much peace in the interim. It will lead us to say, I don't know necessarily what to do, but I've asked the Lord for wisdom and I will continue to ask Him for wisdom and He's going to give it to me. He'll show me. And that'll lead to peace. But this has all been in the context of Psalm 73. Just remembering, just looking at this model that Asaph had, because that is so relatable. Psalm 73, even if it's not, it could be specifically, you know, being envious of the wicked, just like exactly what Asaph dealt with. But we can see, and I hope that I've shown this via the example that I gave just from my own life, that this is there is a much broader application than just that specific scenario. That if we have a wrong perspective, then we just need to get in the presence of the Lord and ask Him for wisdom. And guys, He will do it in your life. He will do it. Try it. Go spend time before Him. Be still before the Lord. Wait for the Lord. Ask Him to speak to you. Make prayer a higher priority and listen. And I know that prayer can be hard. It's easier to read the Bible than to pray, at least in my experience. But the Lord will absolutely speak to us through prayer. And we just got to be diligent to get before Him and to ask for His perspective, ask for His wisdom, ask Him to open our eyes, ask Him to speak to us, and believe that He will. Just like in James, have faith. Pray in faith. Pray in faith, believing. Remember, Jesus said, and let's see here, Matthew 7, He said, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, it will be opened. And that was Matthew 7, 7, and 8. And so that doesn't say ask one singular time. No, this is going to be much more of like a lifestyle, a consistent thing. But just continually come and ask the Lord for wisdom. ask and ask and ask the Lord for wisdom. Ask him for perspective, and then just believe that he's going to answer it. And I can't say how he'll answer it. It could be just kind of like a direct word placed into your heart, like it was for me in that scenario. But a lot of times that answer to wisdom, for wisdom will come through other people. So just be open and be sensitive to the Spirit as best you can, and let's just rely on him in prayer. But guys, I hope this has been encouraging. I hope that it's, as you've been listening, that there have been specific applications that you've already seen in your own life, or areas where you know, yeah, I really need the Lord to speak to me about X, Y, or Z. I don't know what to do, or I need his perspective. And so I hope that those things have been coming into your mind. And I just want to encourage you guys, pray with faith. Pray expectantly. Believe that the Lord will do something, that he'll show up, that he'll give you that wisdom, that he will speak to you. All right, y'all. I hope y'all have a great day. God bless you.